Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forums series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to explore a topic I've been becoming more and more interested in as more and more science about it has emerged in recent months. I'm talking about the microbiome, the name for the environment of microbes that live inside and upon us, and actually virtually everywhere in our world. But it's becoming more and more evident that the state of our individual microbiomes actually has a lot to do with the state of our own health or with the development of certain diseases. You've probably heard of the Human Genome Project, which described the sequence of the human genome, but now the National Institutes of Health is funding the Human Microbiome Project, an ambitious collaborative program designed to reveal much about the human microbiome that is currently unknown. For example, do individuals share a core microbiome? Can changes in the human microbiome be correlated with changes in human health? And how can we manipulate this microbiome and control it and perhaps use it to make our health better? The answers to those and many more questions will no doubt be forthcoming as increased research attention turns to the microbiome, and there is much excitement about the potential benefits to human health we may see from this new and previously unsuspected information. My guest on Radio In Vivo this week is a researcher who is, among other things, actively involved with exploration of the microbiome, specifically in her case, the microorganisms that colonize the human gastrointestinal tract. Dr. Temitope Keku is a research associate professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the UNC School of Medicine, where she has been since 1990. She did her undergraduate work in her native Nigeria and received her MSPH and her PhD degrees from the UNC School of Public Health. Tope's research focuses on the etiology and prevention of colorectal cancer, so we will spend a good bit of our time talking about that disease specifically, as well as her investigation of the gut microbiota. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Good. In relation to colorectal cancer. Tope, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to immediately jump into talking about the microbiome, but I'm going to switch out on you and ask you a more personal question to start our conversation. We were chatting a little bit, obviously, before we came on the air this morning.
Yes.
And so I'd like to get you to tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to enter into this field.
My background originally is in parasitology.
Mm-hmm. Parasitology.
Parasitology, which is the study of parasites. Mm-hmm. And I came into the cancer field when I did my degree in the School of Public Health at UNC. I was majoring in parasitology, but then the program was merged into the EPI program. And so I ended up with getting a degree in a basic science as well as in epidemiology. And so initially I thought, what would I do with this combination? But then the more I got into it, I realized that I could begin to ask questions not only about environment and lifestyle and diet, but also about biological factors that the host, in this case humans, can shed some more lights on.
I see. So, I mean, that's kind of a very interesting evolution of your career there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So coming to the microbiome actually is a full cycle for me.
Indeed, because yes. It goes right back to the parasitology.
Yes.
I see. Well, before we get too specific into your research, Tope, as I mentioned, I'd like to spend some time learning more generally about the human microbiome, because it's just fascinating, and it will help us to have a context to understand your work and why it's so important when we get there.
Yes.
I've touched on it briefly, obviously, but could you describe the microbiome in more detail for us?
Okay. Let me begin by first defining the microbiome. So the microbiome is a total sum of the microbes in and on our body, as well as the microbial genes.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that humans have more bacteria cells in and on us than human cells. So on the order of the magnitude of 10 to 1, so we have more microbial cells.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a recent study, I think was published in earlier this year, showed that 124 subjects had a total of 3.3 billion microbial genes. That is 150 times the human genome. And so this is really fascinating.
It is, because it almost makes it like our own and actual bodies are just carriers for all these, you know, millions and millions of microbes. Trillions, really.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, it turns out that humans are said to be super organisms in the sense that we're a composite of our own cells as well as the microbiome.
I see. And I understand this is actually known as the second genome, or also referred to as the metagenome.
Yes.
And that's an emerging field unto itself, metagenomics.
Yes.
Where do we get all these bugs crawling around? It sounds kind of creepy, but they're infinitesimally small, I'm sure.
Yes. So it turns out that at birth, humans are sterile before birth, but right immediately at birth, humans acquire the microbes through the environment, or through the mother. So some will get it through the mother, some through the environment, and we acquire these microbes, you know, all life throughout our lives.
Mm-hmm. So what is the idea behind this human microbiome project that I was describing a minute ago? What do we stand to learn by sequencing the genomes of these hundreds of different microbes that live inside us?
So the human microbiome project is actually really fascinating. The project is designed to better understand not only the microbes that live in us, but also to create a reference set of genome.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can better look at, characterize who's there. And at the same time, be able to look at correlations with disease, whether they correlate with health, stages, different health and disease. So the human microbiome is actually part of the NIH initiative, the Roadmap Initiative. And it's also a part of an international consortium that includes Europe as well as seven other countries, where their purpose is to characterize the human microbiome. And particularly right at the moment, they're targeting five different areas. They're targeting the oral cavity. They're targeting the GI tract. They're also targeting the female urogenital tract, mm-hmm. as well as the nasopharyngeal tract. and the skin.
And the skin, because yes. obviously we have universally throughout our skin covered with the microbes.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's very interesting, and it's going to be really amazing to watch what emerges from that effort, because it's going to be probably a lot of very unexpected results and valuable results.
Yes, actually, the Human Microbiome Project in the United States is funding 15 different studies to look at the microbiome in those five different areas. And so the findings from those studies, I think, will provide important insight into, you know, not only who is there, but what are these bugs doing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I understand that the only reason that the attention has been drawn to that project and has turned to the microbiome is that now we actually have the tools to be able to examine it.
Yeah, so about, up until 5 years ago, the best way to look at the microbiome was either to culture them or to look at by traditional sequencing, in which we could only look at a few hundred to maybe a few thousand of bugs. Mm-hmm. But with the recent advances in sequencing technology that allows us to look at the bacterial genetic material, without culturing, without cloning, it's just made it very possible to look at, to sequence more samples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm sure the people that are involved with this are just thrilled to have that firepower now and that ability to really look at these types of things.
Yeah, so we've gone from a scale of looking at a few hundred to a few thousands to millions. So these new mm-hmm. sequencing technologies, for example, the Illumina or Pyro sequencing, generate millions of sequences. And so we've gone a big order of magnitude. And so we're able to look at more sites and to look at, to characterize the microbiome in more people.
I'm sure it's keeping some bioinformatics people in business.
Yes.
With that kind of amount of data emerging.
Well, yes. As the microbiome project is progressing, the area of bioinformatics is also coming right along with it, because with the amount of sequencing data that's generated, there's a need to have adequate bioinformatics to be able to analyze all of the sequences, and not only the sequences. So we're also looking at metadata. By metadata, I mean things like diet, so other factors like diet, environment, what obese or not obese. Mm-hmm. So things like that, in order to be able to look at all of that information together, we need adequate bioinformatic tools.
Indeed. And I know that those are developing rapidly as
yes,
well.
Yes.
Focusing on the gut, Tope, where so much of the microbial action seems to be, it's really an entire universe unto itself in there, isn't it? I mean, and we could not survive without the gut microbiota, right?
Yeah. We need the bugs as much as they need us. So I call the microbiota the bugs.
Mm-hmm, okay.
We need them as much as they need us. They perform important roles, for example, in digesting our food, in metabolizing what we eat. They also help to synthesize vitamins, so vitamin K. They also help to keep away pathogenic bugs. So they colonize the area and prevent pathogenic bugs from staying there. So they do have important functions. Mm-hmm. They also help to train our immune system. So studies in animals have shown that germ-free mice that are kept in germ-free environment, have an underdeveloped immune system, which again suggests that the bacteria are important in developing a good immune system.
Sure. Well, that goes right back to, you know, that the gut bugs, if you will, seem to be critical for this so-called hygiene hypothesis, that, you know, kids who have been kept in a very germ-free environment tend to have more allergies and asthma when they grow older.
Yeah, that's correct. And more studies are being done to actually look into that.
Mm-hmm. And I understand food allergies are tied in as well, and the incidence of that, which seems to be ubiquitous today, where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you hardly ever heard of anyone that had a problem like that.
Yeah, I think one of the downsides of the clean hypothesis, I mean, the clean environment, is that the immune system is not trained enough to identify the different varieties of bugs, and so mm-hmm. I think that's part of the problem with this hygiene hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get you to tell us a little bit about an article that I read recently that kind of speaks to the same point. That described a discovery that a large portion of human milk cannot be digested by babies and seems to actually have a purpose quite different from infant nutrition, and that it actually influences the composition of the bacteria in the infant's gut. And a particular strain, which I will not attempt to pronounce, possesses a particular suite of genes that enable it to thrive on this indigestible component of human milk. How cool is that?
That's really cool. Mm. So it turns out that bifidobacteria is the bug that you're talking about, mm-hmm. is common in infants, especially breastfed infants, and so it helps to digest the milk. It has a lot of enzymes that normally humans don't have, and so one of the functions is to help to digest the milk. It turns out that the birth route might actually have an influence on the composition of the gut. So some studies have shown that babies that are born vaginally, mm-hmm. Tend to have the bacteria composition from their mother, versus babies that are born by C-section, for example, don't. And so having bifidobacteria from the mom is beneficial to the babies, mm-hmm. Especially the vaginally born babies.
I wonder if any of that has anything to do with lactose intolerance later in life.
That it's possible.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be looking at that. And I also understand that C-section babies may actually be more susceptible to infections like MRSA and things like that because they don't have that set.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, when babies are born, they acquire the microbiome through either the mother or through the environment. Mm-hmm. So it turns out there was a recent study, I think, by it was done out of Puerto Rico, and the microbiome analysis was done by Rob Knight out of Colorado. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that I think it was a study where they looked at 10 mothers and their children, and they found that babies that were delivered vaginally had a good composition of microbiome from the mother's vagina, mm-hmm. whereas the babies that were delivered by C-section tended to have more bacteria that were associated with skin. And so that might be account for why MRSA is higher in babies with C-section.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Rob Knight of the University of Colorado. He seems to be the rock star in this field. In my research, I kept coming across his name quite frequently. And another really amazing study that he published recently that I wanted to get you to talk about a little bit. He and his team transferred gut bacteria from obese mice with insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, basically diabetic mice, if you will, he took their gut bacteria and transferred that into healthy mice who immediately developed insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. So just the presence of those gut bacteria brought on that disease, basically.
Yeah, that study is really very interesting. And in that study, what they did was that they used animal models, and in the a particular animal model was lacking the TLR5 gene. And this TLR5, the function in the gut is to sense the presence of bacteria. So then if they knock out this gene, they found out that these animals developed insulin resistance and the metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. And if they treated the animals with antibiotics, they were able to mitigate a little bit of the effect of the insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. But then when they transferred the microbiota from these mice, from the knockout mice, they were able to transfer that phenotype. Mm-hmm. And that is really interesting. Yeah. So one of my questions would be, do humans have genetic variation in TLR5 gene? And so humans that have genetic susceptibility to in the TLR5 gene, would they happen to have the same types of syndrome?
I see. Yeah. So that could be a very basic composition of diseases like diabetes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, and those are toll-like receptors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I know those are very being studied.
Yeah, those are actually that's an active area of research at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. Also, in that same study, they showed that the mice who were given the gut bugs from the unhealthy mice also, and given diabetes basically, also started to eat more.
Yes.
So, you know, there you had an example of this transfer and composition of the gut microbiome affecting behavior.
Yes. So it's not only affecting disease, but also affecting the behavior, and that's correct.
So it just seems like the more you look at this, the more the composition of our microbiomes, especially in the gut, has a profound effect on our health, really.
Yes.
And may underlie a lot of diseases and conditions that have remained somewhat mysterious. We've talked about asthma, obesity, mm-hmm. Colitis, mm-hmm. And of course your area of cancer. How can that be? You know, is this just like the flavor of the month? I mean, we've seen things like this come along before, or you know, are they really on to something of really nearly universal importance here?
I think that it's not necessarily the flavor of the month, but I think that the microbes, the more we dive in and look at them, the more we'll find out that they really do play important roles. And I think that all of the studies that are underway will shed additional light mm-hmm. into the roles that they play in all of these diseases. I think the one of the studies that's leading the way right now is the studies in knockout animal models that are kept in germ-free environment, where without germs, you can sort of ask the question, what is going on metabolically with the host? And then in the presence of the microbes, you can ask, you know, what is going on? So I think mm-hmm. I think we're onto something.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, as you've already alluded to, you know, one of the reasons it hasn't been studied that much in the past is the tools haven't been there to do it effectively.
Yes.
Well, here's a question for you, Tope, that I saw in one of the articles I read, and I thought it was a pretty interesting question. How can you have literally 100 trillion bacteria in your gut and not be sick? It just the logic would seem to dictate that if you have that many germs floating around in your tummy, it ought to be making you sick.
Yes. But it turns out that if you remember, I said earlier on that we're super organism in the sense that we have evolved a symbiotic relationship with our bacteria, with the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, we do not know all of the factors that regulate how the body does not kick against those bacteria. But mm-hmm. there is definitely a symbiotic relationship going on. And the more we study, the more we're going to find out how this tolerance to this bacteria is happening.
I see. And I understand that tolerance is actually location specific, that as long as the bugs stay in your gut where they belong and are doing their job, everything's fine and the immune system gives them a pass,
mm-hmm.
but if they, for some reason, escape into the bloodstream, chaos ensues.
Yeah.
And so an immune reaction.
So in the gut, actually, you have immune cells that are in the lining of the gut. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that those immune cells, particularly the dendritic cells, can mm-hmm. go out and sense the bacteria. So they take antigens samples from the gut of bacteria to see who's there. And we think that that's how the tolerance is being trained. Whereas in other parts, for example, in the blood, you don't have that. And so that's why if a bug gets in the blood, the immune system kicks in right away because it's not supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. But the cells in the gut have been trained to recognize those bugs.
What a system. Yes. It's pretty amazing.
It's a pretty amazing system.
Indeed. Well, Tope, how do you think assessment of an individual's microbiome might contribute to, first of all, pharmaceutical development? I understand that there's some work going on in that area. And just generally in healthcare, as in personalized medicine in the future as we go forward with all this.
Well, I mean, I think that that's one of the long-term goals of the future. We're not quite there yet, mm-hmm. but hopefully we will be able to look at someone's profile and be able to use that to group people into risk categories. So what are the chances that a person's likely to get a disease? And based on those profiles, we can also begin to develop ways to be able to manipulate the gut microbiota and to either prevent disease or to help restore health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the quotes I wanted to from this gentleman Rob Knight that we've been talking about that I kind of struck me was he said in one of the articles I read that in terms of developing personalized medicine, it seems like it makes more sense to develop medicines based on the microbiome, where the variation is so great, rather than on the human genome, where the variation is so little. It's a very interesting concept.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting
it'll
to
be
watch
interesting.
It and see,
yes.
see what happens. So stay tuned, right?
Yes, stay tuned.
And stay tuned to Radio In Vivo, where my guest today is Dr. Tope Kekou of the UNC School of Medicine. And we are exploring the mind-boggling world of the human microbiome. Tope, let's turn to kind of apply some of these concepts we've been talking about with your own work on colorectal cancer. Can you just kind of generally describe your research for us in more detail and tell us how the gut microbiome plays into all this?
Okay. So my particular area of research is understanding the etiologic factors, risk factors for colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in looking at genetic factors, environmental factors, namely diet and lifestyle. And I'm also interested in looking at factors related to prognosis in colon cancer. Over the years we've looked at colorectal cancer from several perspectives. It turns out that colorectal cancer begins with changes in the lining of the gut. So it's a disease that progresses with time. It progresses with changes in the lining of the gut, and with these changes, those cellular changes, then the cells overgrow. And as the cells overgrow, they can become polyps. They can form polyps, which are intermediates in the progression to cancer. Mm-hmm. So one angle that we've taken is to say, since polyps are intermediates to colorectal cancer, if we can identify risk factors for polyps, we can prevent colorectal cancer. So sure. One group of studies looking at that. Another group of studies looking at population studies, looking at risk factors, genetic risk factors, and racial and by race. So looking at African Americans and Caucasians. Mm-hmm. It turns out that African Americans, of all the ethnic groups in the United States, have the highest incidence and mortality from colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense to try to understand what's responsible for that. And so some of our studies have looked at that.
Are you suspecting there are biological antecedents to that disparity?
There are, so our studies to date have shown that there are some biological factors, but it's a combination of biological factors, environmental factors, social factors, so mm-hmm. access to care and stuff like that.
Sure.
But My talk today will primarily focus on the adenomas, the polyps.
Okay.
So it turns out that because adenomas are intermediate to colorectal cancer, we can prevent them. And studies that we've done so far show that we've identified insulin as a risk factor for development of polyps. We've also identified a lower rate of cell death as a factor for development of polyps. Mm-hmm. We've also looked at several environmental diet and environmental factors. So we looked at fiber, we looked at vegetable consumption, we've looked at fat, red meat intake. But several other studies have also looked at these factors. It turns out that most of the dietary studies to date haven't given any conclusive answers. So we can really recommend that, well, don't eat this or don't eat that. So take fiber, for example. Mm-hmm. If you look at studies, all the studies that have looked at fiber put together, half of them suggest that fiber is protective. Another half suggests that it's not protective.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. so given that, we think that the inconclusive results may be due to an important component that we haven't looked at, and that's the microbiome.
Okay.
And so that's where the microbiome ties into that.
I see.
And so we've recently begun to look at the microbiome.
Well, that's fascinating, because in terms of the world itself, have there been studies comparing Western diets, say, with Eastern diets? Western diets probably being higher in fat and meat intake and things like that. Has there been any correlation established in that way?
Yeah, so there are studies where they've shown, colorectal cancer incidence varies by geography. Okay. So there are studies that have shown that people that migrate from a low incidence country to a high incidence country like the United States soon acquire the same rates as their host countries.
Mm-hmm.
So their genes didn't change.
Right.
The only thing that changed is the diet. So, and similarly, studies have looked at high-fat diet versus low-fat diet. They've looked at fiber intake versus high-fiber intake versus low-fiber intake. Yeah.
But as you say, most of those results are relatively inconclusive
yes,
at this point.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit more, Tope, about, you know, colorectal cancer itself in the spectrum of cancers. How prevalent is it and how deadly is it typically?
Well, in the United States, it is the third leading cause of cancer death. So it's up there with other cancers.
Mm-hmm.
The American Cancer Society estimates this year alone that there will be about 150,000 new cases and about 50,000 deaths from colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Another estimate suggests that 1 in 15 people will get colorectal cancer. So it's pretty common.
And does it tend to be rapidly progressing and resistant to treatment?
Well, if caught early, there's a 90% survival for first stage colorectal cancer.
Okay.
But as the disease progresses, the survival rate declines.
Mm-hmm.
It's low.
Yeah, as with most cancers.
Yes, as with most cancers.
So, where do you stand on the issue of the routine colonoscopy? So I've had, you probably know Dr. Hadler at UNC,
yes,
and I've
yes.
had him on, and he has some very interesting ideas about screening and early detection and things like that.
Well, so if you look at the latest report from the American Cancer Society and from the NCI, it shows that the incidence rate for colorectal cancer is actually reducing. And mm-hmm. we think that the reduction, we can attribute it to increased screening, because more and more people are getting screened.
Okay.
And so if people get screened, adenomas are found early, they're taken out, and so then you prevent them from having colon cancer.
So what is the treatment if adenomas are detected by colonoscopy?
So if adenomas are detected by colonoscopy, they're taken out. And
surgically
taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And the patient's advised to return every 3 to 5 years. So if you go, the recommended guidelines are that people 50 and over should have screening colonoscopies.
Mm-hmm.
But if an adenoma is found, then they are recommended to come back every 3 to 5 years. If no adenoma is found, they are recommended to come back in 10 years.
I see.
Yeah.
So really on a population level, you're able to detect a real impact here in terms of overall survival.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. So the message there is if you're over 50, go get your colonoscopy.
The message is if you're over 50, go get your colonoscopy. And if you're African-American, the recommended guidelines is age 45.
45.
Yes.
Okay, I see. Let's get back to your work, although okay. That's certainly an interesting tangent we got off on there. You essentially found that an upset in the balance between benign and harmful gut bacteria in a study you published fairly recently, could be associated with the development of these polyps or precancerous adenomas. Am I correct in that kind of nutshell summary?
Yes. So in that study, what we did was, this was a cross-sectional study where we looked at 45 patients. About half had adenomas and half did not have adenomas. And we used, not the newer sequencing technology, but an older method to look at to characterize the microbiota in these patients. And what we found was that there was a shift in the composition of the microbiota. So the patients that had adenomas had more diversity in terms of the total bacteria that was there, and they had more of a different kind of bacteria. So for example, we found that there was more proteobacteria in patients that had adenomas compared to the controls that didn't have adenomas.
Mm-hmm.
And proteobacteria is really interesting in that E. coli belongs to this group. And we know that E. coli is pathogenic, and so we were exploring this further.
I see. So where might that lead, that work?
Well, the work that we're doing right now, we did that in a small population, but we're expanding that study to include a larger number of subjects. We're also and also using the newer sequencing technology.
Mm-hmm, good.
We're also wanting to do a longitudinal study. So one of the things with this study is that we only sample these patients once, and so we have a snapshot.
Sure.
But in order to really get a better picture, it would be nice to look at these patients again. So since the recommendation is that patients that have adenomas come back every 3 to 5 years, we have an advantage here in the sense that we have looked at them at baseline. Mm-hmm. We can, when they come back, we can approach them again. And you know, if they choose to be in the study, then we can also collect more samples from them and look at their bacteria and then be able to say, is there a change from baseline to the next time? And does the baseline bacteria predict future occurrence of new adenomas? So that's one way we're thinking to go forward. Mm-hmm. Another is to look at the profiles of the bacteria that we find and then see if we can put this in animal models and begin to ask not only who is there, but what are they doing?
I see. That it sounds like there's going to be a lot of rich information coming out of what you're doing over the next few years. That longitudinal study especially sounds just like you really stand to learn some very important stuff.
Yes, and I would like to add that all of these studies couldn't be done by myself alone. So this is a collaborative effort with several people.
Sure.
My PI on the NIH-funded study is Dr. Robert Sandler. He's a gastroenterologist at UNC. Mm-hmm. I have other collaborators who do the bioinformatic work at University of North Carolina in Charlotte, as well as Idaho and Nebraska. So it's a big effort and that includes a lot of multidisciplinary investigators.
Well, it seems like most worthwhile initiatives these days take that direction.
Yes. They're
multidisciplinary and highly collaborative, and I know the NIH encourages that type of approach also.
Yes.
Tobe, tell us about some of these newer microbiological methods that have allowed you and other teams to do this type of work. You've talked a little bit about the more recent advances in sequencing, but what are some of the other things, the ability to look at DNA fragments, for example? Tell us a little bit about that.
So it turns out that with the older methods, you could take a sample, extract the DNA, the bacterial DNA from this sample, and then without actually knowing what's there, you could do a fingerprint with the older methods, mm-hmm. and then it gives a pattern of who's there. But with the newer methods, we can take that same DNA straight to sequencing, and based on a gene that's common in all bacteria, this is the 16S RNA gene, you can then begin to ask what are the communities of bacteria that are in a particular sample. And the technology, this technology includes pyrosequencing, which is and also the Illumina. The pyrosequencing allows one to be able to tag, so label multiple samples, and then run them at once. And then by using bioinformatic tools, you can then bin individual samples. So, for example, our samples, we're looking at 150 patients. Mm-hmm. We send those DNA samples for sequencing. The first thing that happens is that they run a PCR that puts a barcode on each sample. And then once the PCR is done, all the samples are pulled together because now they're barcoded. And then they are sent to be sequenced. After the sequencing, each sequence carries the barcode from the sample from which it came from.
Okay.
And so this is a really high throughput. Mm-hmm. And so it then allows one to, by bioinformatics, bin each of the different sequences into different patients. And then with the tools that Rob Knight and others have developed, mm-hmm. one can then begin to ask to compare, different composition in different groups of, let's say, disease states, adenoma versus no adenoma. Mm-hmm. And those tools also allow you to be able to look at diet versus low-fat diet versus high-fat diet and different other variables that one can look at.
So you can query the data for a variety of questions.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
And this is the tool called UniFrac.
UniFrac, yeah.
Yeah, I kept seeing that come up in my research, and it's just amazing what they've been able to conjure up.
Yeah, actually, so he was here visiting at UNC 2 days ago, and he now has a new toolbox called Chime. And this will allow researchers to be able to take their sequences that they get from the sequencing center, put in this toolbox, and be able to do the analysis themselves. Whereas before, researchers had to partner with others to do the bioinformatic analysis for them. Mm-hmm. But with the new Chime, one can take the sequences and run it through this toolbox and get results, be able to look at different communities and be able to query different variables.
I see.
Yeah.
I understand that that people's skin bacteria actually differs so much from individual to individual that these types of tools may actually be able to replace fingerprinting someday in forensics work.
Yeah, so it was interesting. Rob Knight showed a slide 2 days ago where he had taken samples from a person's face, and he was able to sequence all the bacteria in the different regions of the face and then map those sequences back to the face, and you could tell which bacteria were coming from which section of the face. It's really cool.
Wow.
So I think that this is potentially the way of the future.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to watch, particularly what he does. He seems to have quite a feel for this field.
Yes.
The kind of knowledge that's coming out of all this, Tope, what does it mean that you? Let's get back to your work.
Okay.
Enough praise for Dr. Knight, as worthy as he may be of it.
Yes.
the knowledge that you've acquired, particularly in the field of colorectal cancer, what might it mean in terms down the road for prevention or diagnostic advances particularly?
I think this is a good time in the cancer field, especially for colorectal cancer, because now we're not only able to look at genes, diet, gene-diet interactions, but we're able to now include the microbiome. I foresee a future where we'll be able to take to look at an individual and look at their profile, microbiota profile, mm-hmm. and recommend, you know, include, let's say, to cut your risk. So you're at risk for colorectal cancer. In order to cut your risk, you need to include XYZ microbiota in your mm-hmm. diet, maybe in yogurt.
Right, yeah. Right. So the message there really is eat your yogurt.
Eat your yogurt, yeah.
I understand broccoli is a good one, too.
Yes, broccoli is a good one.
Okay. And I understand that this also holds promise in terms of earlier and less invasive diagnosis.
Yes. So
and I know everyone over 50 who hears that message about colonoscopies will very much appreciate that idea.
Yes, so the studies that we published was looking at the lining of the colon. But what would be really interesting would be to look at the fecal matter from the colon, and then if we have similar findings, then it would mean that you could develop a less invasive test to screen for colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And I think that this idea is really not far-fetched. So look at recently there was several studies where they've done fecal transplantation, where a patient had C. difficile, Clostridium difficile, which causes diarrhea, abdominal pain, and it's just messy. Mm-hmm. And this particular study described this patient lost, you know, several pounds, and she was refractory to several of the standard treatment. Right. And so they proceeded to do a fecal transplantation using the fecal sample from her husband. And within 4 days, she was cured.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
this to me is exciting, because it means that we can manipulate the microbiome.
So it's basically a proof of concept,
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
That is a possibility.
Yeah.
And I read that study in the articles, and it is just amazing that a fecal transplantation cured this woman of this very virulent infection.
Yes.
And I happen to know someone who recently suffered that very infection, that Clostridium difficile, and it is tough, and tough to treat, I understand, and proliferating. Apparently, it used to be mainly hospital, nursing home, that kind of environment, but it is proliferating. This was a young, healthy male.
Well, yes, I think that there are fewer studies who are doing that now, but the downside to also doing this fecal transplant is that donors have to be screened.
Sure.
So, and I don't think that everyone is buying into
this. Don't try this at home.
Just yet. Don't try this at home. Yes.
Not that anyone would be likely to do so. Well, Tobe, generally speaking, where is your research headed at this point? I know that you described that you're going to be doing follow-up longitudinal studies. Is that kind of bringing in your skills from the world of epidemiology into your basic science studies as well?
Yes. So doing the longitudinal study will sort of tie together for me my training in basic science with epidemiology. And it would allow us to be able to see, to ask the question, does baseline microbiota predict recurrence of adenomas? Because in a recent study, we showed that patients that have lower levels of apoptosis are more likely to develop,
which is programmed cell death.
Cell death apoptosis, mm-hmm. yeah. And so that's sort of a proof of concept that if we can find that in the human samples, we think that the microbiota may also give us the same signal. So it will be interesting to see whether mm-hmm. whether the microbiota at baseline predict adenoma recurrence. and also whether the change, and then look at the changes over time.
So do you see this even a possibility? I know we just discussed the fecal transplantation as a cure. Literally, it was a cure for an infection. But do you see manipulation of the microbiome as a potential therapeutic?
I see the manipulation of the microbiome as a potential therapeutic. Okay. I think that the long term, so if you ask me what I would like to be known for,
yeah,
it would be hopefully someday to find a way to manipulate the microbiota in the gut to prevent diseases like, you know, colorectal cancer, obesity, heart disease, and the like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How would that work? Do you think, would it work through diet or through pharmacy, or both?
It could be both, but mm-hmm. my guess would be probably through diet.
I see.
Because it's easier to for people to buy into diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, we already have products on the market that are so-called probiotics.
Yes.
That are giving us, you know, are treating our gut, as it were. So this is not a new concept at all.
Yeah.
But it's one that it sounds like with the increased knowledge about what's going on and who's in there, that maybe it can become more refined in the future.
Yes.
Well, Tope, I wanted to ask you also about nothing to do with the microbiome, but I also read about a so-called four-marker DNA methylation tests for detecting colon cancer and perhaps all gut cancers. And that sounded like a very promising thing. Could you describe that for us and what your thoughts are on that?
So the gold standard for detecting colorectal cancer is colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. Another test is the fecal occult blood test. The colonoscopy is expensive. It's invasive. People don't like to get it. Mm-hmm. The fecal occult test is less sensitive and not as specific. So those are the two on the market. And so, if we can get a test that's better, that's not invasive, this cheap, I think is the way to go. So the study that you're describing looked at the plasma of patients, and they identified four markers that are methylated. And so the goal is to develop these four markers as a test as a sensitive and specific test. So if this new marker test is more specific and more sensitive, then it's the way to go.
Okay, and I understand that one of the good things potentially about it, if it can be validated,
yes,
is that even if there is a relatively high rate of false positives, which is a problem with all of these
yes.
tests, that the worst thing that would happen would be that people would maybe get colonoscopies they really didn't need.
Yes,
which, you know, is not wonderful, but it's not you know, a death sentence either.
Yes.
Well, Tope, this is just unbelievably interesting, and your work is fascinating and very important, and it's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on your work, and we'll have you back in a few years and see how the longitudinal study has turned out. So I want to thank you for joining me on Radio In Vivo today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which we update regularly as we book new appearances. And we are also on Facebook, and we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date, and you can always get the schedule in the notes page on the Facebook page. So join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy this program and the many other fine programs on this station, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And a great way to do that right now is to log on to the WCOM website, wcomfm.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how you can make a small monthly contribution and join our Less Than a Latte Club. For less than the cost of just one latte per week, you can help keep this independent voice of the community on the air and thriving. Thanks again for listening, and we will catch you next time.